From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. North Carolina has a controversial history when it comes to its willingness to accept and plan for sea level rise. In 2012, the state legislature enacted a multi-year moratorium on considering data from a science panel for future planning and policymaking. That moratorium has since lifted, and a new study out last year looking at the next 30 years is now accepted as a reasonable basis for policymaking. But in local municipalities, particularly small coastal communities impacted by sea level rise, planners and researchers are quietly going about their work. Today, we'll learn more about what they're considering where sea level rise is concerned and how they're preparing. We'll also learn about whether we're seeing evidence of it and how that shows up locally. Joining us now is Philip Preet. He's a senior planner in the Comprehensive Planning and Design Group with the City of Wilmington. Philip Preet, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you.
Also with us today, Lawrence B. Cahoon is a professor of biology and marine biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Lawrence Cahoon, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question about sea level rise, its potential local impacts, give us a call on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. When many people think about sea level rise and its impacts, they think about the ocean threatening beachfront homes. But the potential impacts of sea level rise are farther reaching. Philip Preet, what impacts are there from the city of Wilmington's perspective?
Well, immediately, we don't see drastic impacts like some areas are seeing. We do have increased flooding, and that's driven partly by increased sea level and also partly by the tidal movement. And in some areas of the city, particularly along the eastern part of the city with where the tidal creeks are, a lot of it is driven also by heavy rainfall and the fact that these soils in that part of the city don't absorb the rain. They are not very good sponges for the rain, so you have a lot of low-lying areas that end up getting inundated. So we see that every time there's a heavy rain, we see some flooding. We've seen more frequent flooding of Water Street downtown. But again, it's something that's not to the same extent that some other municipalities are seeing because we have such a rapid rise off of the river in the downtown area. Now, if you go down south of the downtown area, there's a lot less of a rise and you get more flooding in those areas. And if you look across the river to where the battleship is on Eagles Island, they routinely get flooding over there. The parking lot is inaccessible at times. The street to the battleship is often inaccessible. So then that's because it's a lot more gradual rise from the river.
And Lawrence Cahoon, you recently completed a study that looked at inflow and infiltration when it comes to local sewer systems. Can you tell us first why you were even looking at sewer systems and what this has to do with sea level rise?
Right. I got interested in sewer systems because there's been a history locally of sewer system overflows. And one of the things that drives that is excess water in the system. And the folks who run central sewage systems call it I&I, inflow and infiltration. Inflow is water that's entering the system from above, for example, rainwater leaking through manholes. Infiltration is water infiltrating into the system, collection system from the ground. So basically elevated groundwater levels would drive that. All these collection systems are made of pipes and so forth, and they leak. And a little bit of leakage is normal. It's factored in. But excess leakage is a problem because it can cause the sewer plant itself to function poorly. It can cause sanitary system overflows where the amount of water in the system actually pushes the manhole covers up because of the pressure and blows raw sewage out. You can have other kinds of failures associated with that. Sometimes pipes rupture and that sort of thing. So all of that's bad. It is a problem that's not readily visible. Sewer systems are one kind of infrastructure most people never think about. When we talk about infrastructure, generally, we're thinking roads, bridges, highways, utilities like the electric system and so forth. And we rarely think of sewage systems. We, you know, flush the toilet and we assume that stuff just disappears. It goes someplace and somebody else takes care of it. And it's not quite so simple. Sewer systems are expensive to repair and maintain. They cost about $1 million a mile to install.
$1 million a mile.
That's about the average, yeah.
And when you were conducting this study, what were the boundaries, the geographic boundaries of the study?
We did two studies. One's been published already and the other one's in press. The first one looked at four coastal wastewater treatment systems, the two big ones here in Wilmington, South Side and North Side, Carolina Beach and Beaufort. And we looked for both rainfall effects on sewer system performance and sea level effects. Now, sea level, again, is rising very gradually overall, globally. But what we were looking at was the effect of neap tides versus spring tides. Spring tides, of course, are much higher because of the position of the moon and the sun. And so you see this alternation in tide levels. And what we found was, sure enough, tide levels made a difference in the amount of water going through each one of those four systems. And if you have an extra meter of water, for example, at high tide, the North Side plant, for example, is getting 500,000 gallons a day of extra water coming through. What we think is happening there is that as the tide comes up, the groundwater levels elevate and the sewer system collects a lot more groundwater. In the case of Carolina Beach, what we found was that it was equally dramatic. And I understand that at high tide, they can measure the salinity of the water coming into the plant. It's not huge, but it's there. I mean, there's a saltwater signal at high tide.
And tell us why that is remarkable. Why is that notable?
Well, it means that seawater is getting into your sewage collection system, which is bad for a lot of reasons. It says your system is pretty leaky, for one thing, but seawater is not good for a sewage system. It will cause damage, and you know, we may have time to go through all of the different kinds of damage, but let me skip over to the second study, which was a much broader one funded by a UNC Sea Grant. We looked at all the coastal counties in North Carolina, and we looked at data for 92 wastewater treatment systems in those 27, 28 counties. And what we found was that about 90% of them had an I&I problem, and that is they're getting more inflow and infiltration than they should, according to the normal rule of thumb for designing those systems. And when you throw into the mathematical models a rain event, like a 2-inch rain event in one day, it got much worse real fast. So big rain events make these systems fail at a much higher rate.
And so, Philip Preet, when you consider this as a senior planner with the city of Wilmington, what does that mean in terms of how Wilmington needs to plan?
Well, it's interesting, Rachel, because Larry and I have shared information on some of the work that we've done over the years. And the city actually was funded to do a pilot project a number of years ago where we actually, it was during the time when this moratorium was supposedly in place that you weren't supposed to be doing planning. We had federal funding to do it, so it was really the federal government was doing this work with us. But we looked at the water and sewer infrastructure in the county and looked at several different scenarios of sea level rise and overlaid on top of those scenarios a couple of different scenarios of storm surge just to see over the next couple decades where are we going to have increased potential for the types of things that Larry's talking about with increased infiltration. You start getting sea level rise and you start putting more of the system at risk. And what we found is that there are a number of quite a few manholes that will be subject to inundation in the future. And there are a number of pump stations in the city and county that will be at risk in the future. Now, the thing with pump stations is they're always located in the lowest lying areas because everything flows downhill and then they pump it back to the wastewater treatment plants. So you basically have put these systems in harm's way, and if we continue doing that without thinking about the future, these are not 10, 20 year life cycle systems. We're expecting these systems to last for decades and decades. So we've really got to think into the future when we do this. And that's, the results that came out of this study, we actually had the utility authority and the county as local partners on this project. And so all the information that was generated, all the models that were generated out of this study, the utility authority is able to take those and incorporate into their future maintenance and repair schedules and in their future planning.
And so how old are some of the components in the city's sewer infrastructure system that will need to be replaced or that will be replaced first?
Well, I would say the pattern for replacement of sewer systems is it's done when there's failure. How old some of the system, particularly in the downtown area, is over 100 years old. And in fact, when they were doing some of the street work downtown, they found clay pipe.
Clay pipe. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're learning about the impacts of sea level rise locally and how scientists and planners are taking those factors into consideration. Lawrence Cahoon of UNCW's Marine Biology Department and Philip Preet, a senior planner with the City of Wilmington, are with us today, and they're answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can email your question to us today at coastline@whqr.org or give us a call at 910-343-1138. The phone lines are now open. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're exploring sea level rise and its observable local impacts, both at the beach and further inland. With us today to answer your questions, Philip Preet. I want to call him Phil. Philip Preet, senior planner in the Comprehensive Planning and Design Group with the City of Wilmington, and Lawrence B. Cahoon, professor of biology and marine biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And they're answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can reach us today at coastline@whqr.org or by calling us at 910-343-1138. The phone lines are now open. And I've received multiple pictures this morning from one of our listeners, Robert Parr. He has traveled around the community and taken pictures of flooding. There are some additional factors going on right now as we speak. And you're nodding, Lawrence Cahoon. Can you tell us what some of the factors are that are contributing to the flooding that we're seeing today?
Sea level is an extraordinarily dynamic factor. There are a lot of things that affect it. Obviously, the oscillation of the tides. Right now, we're having a supermoon, a full moon, and so we're getting a spring tide as a result of that. And so the spring tides are normally much higher than the neap tides would be. There are other factors that affect apparent sea level. Wind effects along this coast can be dramatic. We get wind effects on sea level that can be a couple of feet, even without a hurricane or anything like that, can make a big difference. And again, it's a complicated scientific explanation behind that. But on top of that is what we call eustatic sea level rise. That is the global change in the volume of the oceans. And we know that that is changing at about 3.3 millimeters per year going up.
That sounds like a tiny amount.
It does, but it's additive. There are also local effects. For example, in North Carolina, if you go up to Currituck, the apparent sea level rise there is about 4.5 millimeters per year, partly because of land subsidence. If you come down to Southport, it's about half of that. And again, that's because of a little bit of land rising at the coastline there. There are other places in North Carolina, especially inland and marshy areas, where the subsidence of the soils because of seawater intrusion is driving a much higher rate of apparent water level increase.
Philip Preet, senior planner with the City of Wilmington. Just before we went to the last break, you were talking about how looking at some of the infrastructure, specifically sewer systems, some of that would be replaced. There were components of it that were old. You said there's word that some has been, some was made of clay. How old would that be?
I can't say exactly, but some of the lines were 100 years old or older.
And you said that replacement usually comes when there's failure.
Typically, it's either out of necessity or out of convenience. If there's a project where they're redoing the road, then you know they're stripping pavement, and that's a good opportunity. If they have scheduled for a infrastructure for a water or sewer replacement in that area, it's a good time to open up the pavement one time, and that way you don't have to do it twice. So whenever there's a major road project, like when they are doing the Water Street changes, you know, the streetscape improvements down on Water Street, it's taken a long time because the first part of that is to get down there and replace some of the stormwater and the water and sewer infrastructure below Water Street while they are in the process.
So Bob is asking what future tide levels are part of the new design criteria and when in the future will these new modifications need to be modified again?
That's a good question, and it's I think it really depends on the area, on where we are. If you're looking at Water Street, for example, since we're talking about that, which is already occasionally flooded, then if you've got subsurface infrastructure, then it's difficult to, you know, you've got an existing road that basically dictates that elevation, so it's difficult to change that elevation. Now, where we should be thinking about changing elevations or accommodating sea level rises in new development or new areas where we extend new water and sewer or new roads, we should be factoring that in. In fact, the Department of Transportation does factor sea level rise now into some of their road planning and design and their bridges because you might have issues with the clearance under a bridge in the future. And again, this is infrastructure that has a long lifespan. It might be 50 years or longer, so you want to factor in at least that much of a time frame in the planning.
So I know that you're with the City of Wilmington, but when we look at, say, the recent construction on the Leland Causeway and the bridge that goes over Alligator Creek, that was elevated compared to the old bridge. But how much sea level rise are they taking into account there at this point?
I don't know the answer to that in detail. I know that they are looking at models, and I think they're looking at probably not the most the highest scenarios. They're looking at middle of the road scenarios, and it's one of those situations where, and this is one of the big things that drives a reluctance to make policy changes based on the projections of sea level rise into the future. If you look into the near future, we're pretty certain how much it's going to rise. There's a range, but we're pretty certain that we can hit pretty close. But as you start to go out further into the future, that range gets wider and wider and wider. And if you...
Well, what are we even talking about when we talk about near-term versus a long-term view? I mean, the science panel that was, ultimately fully rejected by the state legislature. I think they published their report. It might have been 2010, but it was 2012 that the state legislature said, we're not taking that into account when it comes to making any kind of policy decisions. And then in 2015, that moratorium lifted. And that's when a new report came out that looks at, 30 years? Is that Is that short term or is that long term?
Well, that's really – it depends on what you're thinking about. It's short term for some investment. It's long – it's pretty much the – I mean, it's the, I think the reason they picked 30 years is there was a lot of, I think, realtor direction behind the legislation and behind the science panel, and that's the basic lifespan of a typical house mortgage is 30 years. So, you know, from the standpoint of being able to plan for private homeowners, 30 years is a pretty reasonable number. But if you're talking about, again, infrastructure is going to be in place much longer than that, then you want to take a longer view. When they first came out with the first science panel, came out with the first report in 2010, they looked clear to the end of this century. So, you know, it was quite a bit different horizon. And when we did the infrastructure study, the pilot project we did in the city, we used that same kind of scenario. We looked out to the end of the century and we bracketed the scenarios at the same range that the science panel originally came out with. So, you know, that was something that, you know, we now have that data. We have those models. It was the modeling was assisted by the North Carolina Division of Emergency Management, which had a significant amount of FEMA money to revise their floodplain models as well as to do some scenario analysis of sea level rise.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of sea level rise, current and potential local impacts. We have two experts here today to answer your questions on this Wednesday. Philip Preet is a senior planner in the Comprehensive Planning and Design Group with the City of Wilmington, and Lawrence B. Cahoon is a professor of biology and marine biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. You can ask your own question of our guests on this Wednesday by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org or call us at 910-343-1138. We have Nancy from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, why do they have sewage pumping stations at the heads of some of our creeks, in particular Hewlett's Creek? It's spilled over from that area many times, and why don't they move them? Why don't they do, you know, why were they put there in the first place?
Nancy, I'm sure a lot of people have the same question. We'll toss that to Philip Preet. Thank you so much for your call.
Can I hang up and listen?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The basic reason is basic physics. When you're dealing with sewage, it's a liquid that's going to flow downhill. And most of the sewer lines that we have in place are what's called gravity flow sewer lines, because it's much cheaper than the lines that require pumping. So you get as much of it to go down to a low location as you can, and then you pump it up to the wastewater treatment plant. So just by cost and the physics of the whole thing, these pump stations get located in the lowest lying areas. And that's, you know, it's kind of a double whammy, because you do have that potential for sea level to impact the pump stations, but you also have very little buffer if they are to fail, because you end up with your sewage right there flowing into the creek. So, you know, with the pilot project that we did, we ended up with a number of different recommendations for how to deal with this going into the future. So if the utility authority begins to upgrade one of the pump stations or to do maintenance on it, if they elevate if they put a berm around the pump station, it can do a lot to reduce the risk there. Or if they raise their power boxes on the pump stations, that can do a lot to reduce the risk of failure. That doesn't get them out of those low-lying areas, but it does make them a little less susceptible to failure. And as far as moving them, it would be very expensive to move a pump station. It's not a cheap piece of infrastructure. Mm-hmm.
Lawrence Cahoon, a couple of times during this discussion, you've alluded to the fact that rates of sea level rise are different in different parts of the state. Why is that? Why is this a dynamic thing, and why is it different in, say, the northern part of North Carolina versus our region?
Right. A lot of that is the underlying geology. You know, we think of the coastline as being cast in stone, so to speak. In fact, there's very slow geological effects that are causing the land itself to rise in certain areas of the country and of the world, and other places where geological effects are causing the land to sink, usually very slowly.
And the land subsidence, that's right. The land sinking.
That's right.
And that's what I've heard about in conjunction with sea level rise.
That's
the
right.
Land is also rising in places?
There are places where you're having a little bit of geological uplift. For example, I mentioned the Southport area. That's an area that has seen some uplift. It's very gentle. It's, you know, about a millimeter per year, something like that. But it counteracts roughly one-third of the global sea level rise effect. There are places like Norway and Sweden where after the glaciers melted, the landscape actually rose after all that weight of ice was removed. So there are places where sea level appears to be falling. But if we take the global measurement and integrate all of that over the entire planet, the sea level, the volume of water in the oceans is rising, again, about 3.3 millimeters per year, something like that.
Philip Preet.
Yes, just to add to that, I think, you know, we talked a little bit about the science panel's report that they came out with in 2010, and then it pretty much got scrapped, and there was direction by the Coastal Resources Commission to develop a new report, which they've published. One of the positive things that came out of the new report was looking at the types of variations in sea level rise along the North Carolina coast. The 2010 report, they used projections of global sea level rise. And Larry mentioned that it's, you know, based on a global mean. But with the more recent report that was published in 2015, that came out in 2015, they were required by the Coastal Resources Commission to look at four different regions of the North Carolina coast and take into consideration the land subsiding in those different regions and the different rates. So they came back with, again, and this is what Larry alluded to or mentioned, that up in the northern part of the coast, the rate of increase will be higher, and partly because of soil subsidence at a faster rate, but than the southern part of the North Carolina coast.
So what causes land subsidence? Why is land sinking? Lawrence Cahoon.
Well, there's a couple of factors there. One of them is the underlying geology. The Earth's crust actually is dynamic in that way. And again, when you've had glaciers cover, for example, a large portion of North America, a lot of that is rebounding. And you're seeing regional effects where some areas are rebounding and others are actually tilting downward in compensation. So there's that kind of background effect. In addition to that, in the coastal region of North Carolina, we have a lot of places where the soils are largely organic, made of peat from marsh accumulation over time. And as seawater intrudes into those soils, the salinity itself can foster the growth of bacteria that decompose that organic matter. So the soils themselves are actually decomposing and therefore settling. And so what we're seeing in some of the inland areas where you've got saltwater now getting into places that used to be freshwater marshes, you're seeing a very high rate of land subsidence. Again, the land sinking, and therefore sea level rise apparently exceeding the rate you see elsewhere and accelerating the process. So there are places in coastal North Carolina that are in very big trouble.
Philip Preet.
Yes, just to add to that, another factor is that when you are pumping groundwater for use, you're also you're removing some of the subsurface pressures that help to keep the earth elevated. So either groundwater extraction for our drinking water supply, which we pump quite a bit out of wells here in this county, but also if you had oil or gas extraction, again, that can change the dynamics and cause additional soil subsidence.
Well, that's interesting. And where might we see oil and gas extraction?
You might see it in some of the coastal areas in the Gulf of Mexico, for example. And, you know, depending on what happens in the future, you may see it along our coast as well.
And I thought along the coast, you're talking about in the ocean? Are you talking about offshore drilling, or are you talking about hydraulic fracturing, for instance?
Well, I'm not talking about hydraulic fracturing. That's okay. Another issue. But the offshore drilling is still, I mean, it's there's not like a subsurface wall underground between what's under the ocean and what's under our land surfaces. So, it's all connected. So it's still going to be, can potentially impact the soil subsidence rates.
Larry Cohn.
It's certainly the case in Louisiana where oil extraction and gas extraction on what was land has caused local subsidence. They're seeing very rapid declines in the elevation of the landscape in coastal Louisiana. It's almost the poster child for that sort of effect. When you get farther offshore, especially North Carolina, it looks like the primary oil and gas interests would be out on the edge of the continental shelf, fairly far out and fairly deep. So I would expect the land effects to be fairly small from extraction of those resources out there. Because they are so far away and because the underlying geology probably doesn't leave a resource for them to extract that comes very close to shore.
Okay, and we're going to talk more about how we're seeing evidence of that here. I know, Lawrence Cohn, you've talked about an accelerated rate in Dare and Hyde counties. We'll talk about southeastern North Carolina when we come back. You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of sea level rise and its local impacts. What's science? What do we know? What's legitimately speculation? We have UNCW's Lawrence Cohn and the City of Wilmington's Philip Preet answering your questions today. You have one more segment to ask your question by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org or calling us at 910-343-1138. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's a discussion about sea level rise and how planners are preparing for it, both at the beach and further inland. We have two experts on the subject answering your questions on this Wednesday. Philip Preet is a senior planner in the Comprehensive Planning and Design Group with the City of Wilmington. And Lawrence B. Cohn is a marine biology and biology professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. You can ask your question on this Wednesday by calling 910-343-1138 or by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. And before we went to the break, Lawrence Cohn, you were kind of explaining land subsidence, some of the geologic causes of it. And you've said that it's more observable. It's happening at a faster rate north of us in Dare and Hyde counties specifically. But where here are we seeing land subsidence?
Where you've got organic soils, wetlands in particular, those soils, as they receive more input of salt water than they're used to, you'll see a change in character, for one thing, from a freshwater flora to saltwater flora. But the soil bacteria are able to use the sulfate ion in seawater. I don't want to get too technical, but they can use that to metabolize that organic matter in those organic soils. And they basically decompose those soils. So they begin to settle and subside simply because they're being destroyed. And you see that taking place in the northern part of the county, the wetland areas up there. You see it. Matter of fact, Phil brought up.
You're talking the northern part of New Hanover
County. New Hanover County, yeah.
Okay.
When you talk about how the battleship access roads and parking lot are being flooded, it isn't just that the tides are higher. They are. It's also that land is wetland. and it's subsiding. And so they're getting a much more amplified effect of sea level rise than they would otherwise.
We see lots of coastal flood advisories affecting Battleship Road and downtown Wilmington, particularly a couple of blocks on Water Street. Philip Preet, is that land subsidence also on Water Street, and or is that sea level rise? What's causing that, and why is it happening more often?
It's, I mean, obviously land subsidence plays into it, but that's a long, long-range, long-term change. I think what we're seeing more of is that there is an increasing level of the river, because driven partly by sea level rise, but we also see, as Larry spoke to earlier, we see the tides themselves. And when you have, you know, we get daily low and high tide fluctuations, and across the river, the flooding will be a lot more frequent with a lot less of a tide. On Water Street, it's going to be more likely when we have some of the king tides or some of the, you know, the higher high tides. But that's part of the cause.
And tell us briefly what a king tide is, the difference between that and...
Well, the king tide is when you have the supermoons, and it drives a larger fluctuation in the tides than your typical full moon.
Which is what we're seeing right now.
Correct.
Lawrence Cahoon.
Yeah, let me throw in another factor that's relevant for us here in Wilmington. Of course, we have a state port here, and the river has been dredged to deeper and deeper depths, and that allows more ocean water to get farther upstream. That's a big factor. It probably also amplifies the tidal range here at Wilmington, just because it's easier for high tide to get here. You know, that water's got to slosh all the way up the river and all the way back out again. And so certainly that is a factor in all of the effects that we've been talking about. But on top of that, you have sea level itself going up and the land subsiding. So we've actually engineered ourselves into a lot more trouble than we would have had otherwise.
Philip Preet.
One other factor at play here is the fact that we often have large rain events. And in fact, we're getting larger and larger rain events and more frequent large rain events in our area and other parts of the coast. And so a lot of what you see is sort of a combination of the tidal fluctuation, sea level rise, plus the runoff from these large rain events. And as we've developed, we've added more and more impervious surface within our city. That means the water runs off faster, but it goes to low areas. And often those low areas, for example, on the eastern part of the city along the tidal creeks, Bradley Creek, Hewlett's Creek, et cetera, those are the low-lying areas that we see flooding the most. And we've got the city has a stormwater services department that spends a lot of time and money trying to fix that problem. But that's not just the tidal changes or sea level rise. It's also just the fact that we've got a lot of development in areas that used to be soils that would absorb that rain, and it's no longer there. It's running off of pavement. But we also have a lot of those low-lying areas is where some of the most poorly drained soils are, the wetland areas and the areas that are the organic soils. So they don't absorb the water as much, and that's where we see a lot of the flooding.
Well, thinking about, you talked about looking out 100 years yourself for the sake of local planning. We recently got new information about vulnerabilities of Greenland's ice shelf, things that we didn't know, assumptions that had been made for a long time. This was just published in the journal Nature. Could be more vulnerable than we thought, melting faster, contributing to sea level rise. And then just this week, a report published was looking at what they call the tri-state area up north, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. They found sea level rise could permanently flood parts of New Jersey by the early part of the next century. So I think we're talking about 100 years. The Jersey Shore, half of Hoboken and the Teterboro Airport. Are there areas here? That's very concrete. You can imagine that. Are there areas here when we look out 100 years? And I realize the science is less stable than looking out 30 years. But what might we see? Can you name things like that? Lawrence Cahoon.
Let me take that opportunity to cast the bigger picture here. We know that the ice sheet at Greenland is melting at an accelerating rate, and I gather from what you said about this latest study that there are things at work that we hadn't previously known about. Let's put it this way. When the Earth was this warm in geological history, sea level was 6 to 7 meters higher than it is today. Okay. Because of what we call climate inertia, the ice melt effects that the current levels of global temperature will drive is going to get us that 6 or 7 meters. How soon, we don't know. The panel that got into trouble, the CRC science panel,
back in 2010,
correct, was using an estimate of about 1 meter of global sea level rise by 2100. And that was at that time considered to be more or less a consensus of the projections. Now, all projections are risky. You know, many things can happen. But if you extrapolate current trends and that sort of thing based on what we now know, it looks like 1 meter or so is not at all unreasonable by the
And what does that put underwater in our area, Philip Preet?
Just from the modeling that we've done and had done here, when you start looking at that 1 meter of rise and you start looking out towards 50, 100 years out, then some of the areas that are lower lying, like along the tidal creeks, you're going to see those start to get inundated. And there's a lot of very nice homes in those areas.
So we're talking about people who live near Bradley Creek, for example.
Exactly. And also along the river, there's certainly parts, lower-lying areas of the river once you get down south of the bridge. And one of the things that when you start looking out into the future, you start to see that our state port is somewhat vulnerable and has some areas that would potentially be at risk, as well as some of the southern areas along River Road could potentially be at risk. And if you look at other areas where they are focusing on trying to make some changes because of sea level rise, the one that really comes to mind where they're really taking a serious look at it is Norfolk, the Norfolk Hampton Roads area. And that's because they've got the naval base there, and they realize that this is something that could put our national defense at risk, because you've got, it could affect the naval base. So they're pumping a good bit of money into working with the local universities, working with the local communities and the federal and state government to look out into the future and try to figure out ways that they can take care of that issue.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of sea level rise, current and potential local impacts. We have Philip Preet, senior planner with the City of Wilmington, with us today, and Lawrence B. Cahoon, a professor of marine biology and biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. You can ask your question by emailing coastline@whqr.org or calling us at 910-343-1138. Tony from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, you may have answered my question already in part with a 1 meter sea rise, but I'm just wondering, what is the possibility of changing this whole thing? If we take some reasonable actions, or if we look at reasonable actions we can take to reduce the warming and the seawater rise, are we going to be able to turn it around, or do we have an elephant we can't get back into the compound?
Great question.
Yeah.
Lawrence Cahoon. Thanks, Tony.
I think that and this is, it's a matter of opinion, but physically speaking, that much sea level rise is already baked into the system. The current temperatures aren't going to go down without massive intervention, global geoengineering and those kinds of things. I see no prospect for that in the immediate future. I'd be surprised if sea level rise is only 1 meter by the end of the century, but I think we have a major problem on our hands, and we're going to have to adapt to it.
We have an email from Amy. She says, I live off Masonboro Sound Road. With the expansion of the sewer and water within city limits, new pumping lift stations have been placed in areas that seem to be in the floodplain. Am I wrong to think it's a problem? Philip Preet.
No, you're not wrong to think it's a problem, and we did talk about that a little bit in the last segment where there are a number of pump stations that would be vulnerable with increasing sea level rise. And the trick is to either elevate the surrounding, build berms around these pump stations, or do something to shore them up.
Which sounds like something of a stopgap. I mean, she says new pumping lift stations. Why new ones?
Well, there's every time we have new development, we're going to have to do something to handle the sewer. Why are the new ones going in those areas? It's still the same reason. As long as we've got development in those low-lying areas, there's going to be sewer infrastructure that serves those low-lying areas. And again, it has to be out of basic physical principles. It has to be in the lowest lying areas so that you get the gravity feed.
We have Ben from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It's an interesting discussion. And I have a two-part question. Earlier in the segment, you guys were describing that the abstraction of oil and or groundwater can lead to subsidence. Now, I'm not aware of any local oil abstraction in coastal North Carolina. So that leads me to my first question. Do you think the population, not just New Hanover County, but all up and down the coast of North Carolina, do you think the population that relies on well water is large enough to, you know, lead to localized subsidence?
That's a good question, Ben. And Philip Preet, you have an answer for that. And do industrial operations also contribute to this problem?
Yes, industrial operations can contribute to it. And that was one of the major issues that a lot of folks were concerned about with the cement plant that was going to go in along the Northeast Cape Fear River, because they were going to pump tremendous amounts of groundwater, which could help to exacerbate this problem.
And there are current operations along in that area that are using
a lot. There are current operations in that area, but we also have some large well fields that the utility authority operates to get drinking water for our for the residents and for our businesses. And there, basically we're dealing with a perfect storm situation, because we do have population increases. We're projecting, it could be as many as 50,000 new people coming to our area. And, that's going to be more demand for the water. And it's going to be also, you've got with sea level rise, you're potentially putting that groundwater supply at risk, because you get saltwater intrusion into the your wells, and they're already experiencing that if you go a couple counties to the north of us.
And we have a question from Harper Peterson, who asks Lawrence Cahoon specific advice to he's nailing you down here, city and county planners and developers regarding long range land use and development. Are there certain parts of the city, this area, that we just need to take off the table?
Hi, Harper. I'm not sure we can do that politically. As I may have said a while back, or it may have been our private discussion, I think what's going to drive retreat, which Phil says is a dirty word, is probably going to be storm events, things like that, big floods, where the economics of a given situation dictate that you're going to have to pull out, rather than a policy-driven kind of response. So I suspect that we're going to see this happen sort of by surprise. We can predict with some certainty that there will be more floods, there will be more storms, and so on, but it will be a surprise when it happens.
That's all the time we have today. And we do have a question from Jeff, who wants to know about those studies of the local sewer systems, whether they're publicly available. We'll post that information on our website. That's this edition of Coastline. Lawrence Cahoon, Philip Preet, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Today's show was engineered by Caleb Covington. Join us on the next Coastline for festive food with the local superstar chefs from Pinpoint and Mana. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at our website, whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.